From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Today, the world according to popular culture. We'll find out what pop culture can teach us about the Muslim world, Christianity, and sex. Also, we'll meet Nathan Rabin. He'll tell us how pop culture saved his life.
I think I would be completely insane if it weren't for pop culture. I think I would lose my struggle with depression.
But first, Richard Poplack. Poplack was born in Johannesburg, South Africa. He emigrated to Canada with his family shortly before Nelson Mandela's release from prison in 1990. Poplack is the author of The Sheikh's Batmobile, In Pursuit of American Pop Culture in the Muslim World. He told Anne Strainchamps what inspired him to write the book.
I learned about an Arabization of The Simpsons. So, and this is sort of what sparked the idea for me. I was in Johannesburg working, doing the usual surfing on the internet, and came across the story that The Simpsons had been not just translated or dubbed into Arabic, but literally Arabized, which I guess could be termed reculturating for a conservative audience, specifically a Saudi audience.
What does it mean to Arabize The Simpsons?
Well, it means to make sure that Homer, or now Omar Shamshoon, does not drink Duff beer. He drinks Duff soda, or a kind of a juice. He doesn't eat bacon, of course. Rabbi Krestovsky is no longer with us. Those sort of things. So literally excising anything that could be termed offensive to, you know, your average fundamentalist.
And is Omar Simpson, is he still an American? Is this still a sitcom about an American family? Or has the Simpson family, all of them, now been transplanted to a mythical Arabic country?
Well, this is the absurd thing. The guy who Arabized The Simpsons is a brilliant Egyptian poet and a very, very funny and brilliant man named Amr Hosni. And he insisted that what he terms the Sheikhs at NBC, which was a satellite television station that commissioned his work, he insisted that they do not remove the Shamshoons, who are the Arab Simpsons, from America. Nope, this takes place in some weird version of America.
How does that play out then? I mean, are all of is the Shamshoon
poorly.
Family poorly? Is the Shamshoon family an Arabic family just that happens to be plunked down in, you know, Springfield, Ohio, or wherever they are?
It's just some weird Saudi mandated version of what America is viewed through the lens of yellow people running around the place. Amr Hosni was tearing his hair out about this. He felt that he had a great opportunity. He loves the original The Simpsons. He thinks it's a brilliant show and had a lot to speak to Arab audiences if he had just been allowed to dub it properly. But nope, they wouldn't allow him to do that.
You must have watched some episodes of Al Shamshoon.
I did, yeah.
What's it like?
It's terrible. It's very, very flat. The voice work is indifferent. It doesn't make any sense. My Arabic is very poor, but Amr was translating it for me. And yeah, or the jokes don't work.
So it really bombed.
Oh, it bombed huge, yeah.
Why did anybody think that Arab viewers would like an Arabized version of The Simpsons to begin with? The Simpsons is a very satirical take on American culture filled with a lot of almost in-jokes. What made network executives think this would play in the Arab world?
Well, despite what a lot of Arab intellectuals will say, at least the Egyptian dialogue fits enormously well with American humor. There's the same sort of level of sarcasm, the same biting satire. The show could have worked quite successfully, and a number of similar products have. But I think what excited the Saudi executives at NBC about The Simpsons is that, and brilliantly so, it's a product. It's something that they could endlessly milk. There's 22 seasons, I think, at this point, of The Simpsons, plus a movie. It could have been an endless cash cow for them. All they do is Arabize and Arabize and Arabize, and boom, they're set for 22 years. I think it looked enormously attractive to them from that point of view. They just insisted on making sure that it offended absolutely no one, and that's obviously where they went wrong.
So are there a lot of young people in the Middle East who are obsessed with, heavily involved with North American pop culture?
As far as my travels would lead me to believe, I think that's definitely the case. How they're obsessed and how they're involved is what's interesting to me. The obsession is at once healthy and at once unhealthy. But it also, I think one starts digging through the cultural roots, there's some very, very surprising connections. I'm thinking here specifically about my time in the Palestinian territories and in Gaza, where I was looking at hip-hop and how hip-hop has become again, a very specific Palestinian cultural product. And how the hip-hop heads there, who are in every way obsessed with hip-hop, have made it their own. But there are also links, very specific links, between American hip-hop and Palestinian hip-hop.
How do the politics of this play? Because you would think that young, political, edgy Palestinians would not want to adopt anything American.
The politics play out very, very queasily. Yeah, there are all sorts of levels of complications with regard to, especially with regard to hip-hop in Palestine. And a lot of the guys who started rapping are quite insistent that this is not an American art form. Although it was sort of started by black Americans, or at least popularized by black Americans in the Bronx and in New York during the 70s and the 80s, it's a traditional Arabic form of music. If you listen to the Quran, the cadences are very similar. There's obviously links between hip-hop and Nation of Islam in America. And they'll look to those links rather than, you know, Jay-Z to suggest that, no, this is a form of music that is, you know, sort of indigenous to us to some degree.
So what is Palestinian hip-hop like?
It's very good. In fact, I'd argue that a couple of Palestinian bands, specifically Dam and Ramallah Underground, are two of the best hip-hop bands, or at least underground hip-hop bands working today. نازل بلعب في الموت بدي يعرف ايش عدد الموت هون مش سامع ولا الصوت اتس التليفون اسأل لانه ولا حد سائل سواء سياسي او دبلوماسي قاعدين على الكراسي وبتحدثوا بروحوا بحطوا روسهم وبتمددوا والبيوت في لبنان وغزة عم بتهدموا اجا الوقت نفع بابوس لكل العالم لانه راح يضلوا يحكي وعمره ما حيعمل فايش بدنا نضلنا نقنع ونستنى بتمنى بس عالفاضي من زمان نسيوا عنا صعب تمسك حالك لما تشوف قدامك اللي قامك واللي شالك مش مستغرب اذا افكار جهنمية عم بتدور في بالك نازل بتنادي على الدنيا بس الدنيا نامت وحتى اذا قامت ما حتسمع كلامك ما حتسمع كلامك هون يوم معاك مية عذيك حواجز حواليك They are furious. Their flow is amazing. Their beats are good for the fact that they're not, you know, mixed by million-dollar producers. It's very, very good stuff.
What do they rap about? What are their lyrics like?
It starts and ends with the occupation. So these are political bands to the extreme. But surprisingly, there's a lot more nuance in their music than you'd find in your average sort of leftist Palestinian rhetoric. They speak a lot about the social problems in Arab-Israeli towns like Lod or Ramla, which are very tough towns. They speak about drug problems. They speak about crime. They speak about a lot of stuff that you just, kitchen sink drama type stuff that you just don't hear outside of the context of the occupation.
Hmm. Yeah, one of the things that I wondered reading about some of your trips is this cultural transmission so far seems to be pretty much a one-way street. So you've got kids in the Middle East who are listening to American music and being inspired, but, you know, Indonesian punk and Egyptian heavy metal is not making it on radio playlists in the U.S.
One of the things that I'm endlessly surprised about is, you know, we keep on being told that the internet has opened things up, globalization, blah, 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 idea exchange and so on. But I'm always a little astonished at how the conversation is so one way. We are not as curious in North America as I've always thought we should be. It's a little sad, I think. You know, you think of George Harrison bringing back the sitar from India back in the 60s. It just isn't that level of interest anymore. And I think there's something paradoxical about the internet in that it stifles curiosity to some extent. You know, the world's getting smaller, but people aren't traveling to places like Indonesia to look for new sounds anymore.
How does this American cultural transmission, how does this play out between the generations in some of these Middle Eastern countries? Because a lot of what you're talking about is exactly why, well, it's one of the reasons we're fighting the wars we're fighting in the Middle East, you know, because Muslim fundamentalists are reacting against American pop culture.
It's almost as if a lot of the countries that I visited are cut almost by like a cross. And one of the big rifts is generational. It's massive. And because there are so many more young people in these countries than old people, it's a massive, massive rift. What a lot of these countries are going through is pretty much an argument between old and new. how do we move forward when, you know, this part of our culture is physically and I guess culturally dying? And how do all these new young people and all these new young ideas mesh? These conversations are enormously fraught in these cultures, and they're enormously dangerous. The other fault line is, of course, religion. But I wonder, I wonder still if the generational conflict isn't the one that will bring a number of these countries to their knees much quicker than the religious one.
Yeah, that's a point really worth making. I must say I was really surprised in your book to read that the average age in most of the countries you visited was far younger than I would have expected.
In a country like Yemen, we're talking an average age of less than 20, which is almost unimaginable in countries as old as the States or Canada. As old, I mean, age-wise. Yeah, it's a real, real issue. It's a social issue that is, it couldn't be larger.
Well, you think about what happened to the U.S., the massive cultural transformation that the U.S. went through in the 60s when
exactly.
The baby boomers came of age, hit 16, 17, 18. Are we looking at something similar happening in the Middle Eastern world?
I think we are, yeah. I think where the real social explosion is going to happen is when a lot of these kids come of age, they look forward and understand that their countries are, to some degree, in their own hands. And it's not a change that's going to happen overnight, and it is a change that's happening, especially in countries like Egypt. There is a changeover going, it's bubbling under the surface, and no one quite knows how it's going to play out. But it will certainly play out, or at least a number of these battles will be fought on the culture battlefield.
Well, in the meantime, for an 18-year-old who's living in Afghanistan or Libya or Palestine, how much courage does it take? Does it amount to an act of bravery on their part to, say, join a band, play hip-hop or heavy metal or punk rock?
Yeah, it's very difficult for us over here to understand. And I feel myself even dull to it after having been away for a year or so. It is so dangerous in some of these countries to get involved in some of the subcultures that these kids choose. It really is looked down upon, certainly by the religious establishment, by the political establishment, and by their parents and their elders. It is an enormous challenge to identify yourself as a heavy metal in Iran, so much so that a lot of these kids' lives are tragic on account of it. I mean, all they want is to be able to rock out. It's essential to their sense of individuality. And the notion that this is being stifled, it was, especially in a place like Iran, certainly in Afghanistan, and in Egypt as well, it was just tragic how much these kids just wanted to be left alone to rock out. And, that wasn't going to happen.
That's interesting, because I was wondering, what happens when all these kids grow up and, as you said, take control of their country? Will they wind up feeling much more sympathetic to America and American interests because they grew up watching American sitcoms and playing American rock music?
Well, at base, they'll know a lot more about American culture than Americans would know about their culture, for one thing. I mean, they understand the rhythm of how our lives work. Just by watching a sitcom, I guess, to some degree, you get a notion of suburban culture. Now, of course, it's a warped notion. And as a South African, when I came over to North America, I was a little stunned at how things actually play out. There's always a culture shock difference. But yeah, I think encoded in a lot of pop culture are some really, really beautiful ideas and some really, you know, natively American ideas, that sense of American optimism, that sense of beautiful individuality linked to community. And I don't think it's a bad thing that those ideas are being exported to these countries.
Richard Poplack is the author of The Sheikh's Batmobile, In Pursuit of American Pop Culture in the Muslim World. What do you think of the popularity of American pop culture in the Arab world? We'd love to know what you think. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, Christian popular culture and the story of a British biologist who reinvented himself as a sex guru as we continue to explore the world according to pop culture. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Thank you.
Daniel Radosh is the author of Rapture Ready, Adventures in the Parallel Universe of Christian Pop Culture. Radosh describes himself as a liberal New York secular Jew, but he got a taste of Christian pop culture in September 2005.
I was visiting my wife's family out in Kansas and tagged along with her teenage half-sister to a Christian rock festival. And I'd never been to one before. And while we were there, one of her friends comes running up after a set and says, "Dude, that was an awesome performance. They prayed like 3 times in a 20-minute set." And I had just never heard rock and roll evaluated on that criteria. And it occurred to me, well, not only does this seem something amusing, but also maybe that there's something actually interesting and important going on here that I should know about if I want to understand what this world is really about.
You know, what's fascinating about that is that you're right. My first reaction was, oh, no. I mean, I wanted to laugh. But in fact, whoever said that was quite serious, weren't they?
Absolutely. And I wanted to really figure out, you know, everyone understands that evangelicalism is a growing and important movement in America. But it's understood in kind of narrow terms from the outside. It's seen as a political phenomenon or a theological phenomenon or a social phenomenon. But I think that if somebody, for example, had, you know, memorized the entire United States Constitution and watched C-SPAN every night and knew how the entire education system worked, but had never heard of Elvis Presley or Oprah Winfrey or Jerry Seinfeld, I think you could make a good case that that person really didn't know anything about America.
And you're saying that these people have memorized the Bible and know all sorts of things, but?
Well, I think that outsiders have that kind of understanding of American evangelicalism. There's this huge pop culture component to it of not just music, which we kind of all are aware that Christian rock exists, but Christian comedy and theme parks and even Christian pro wrestling. And I wanted to explore that world through that particular lens, also because it's a lens that I'm comfortable with as, you know, an ordinary American consumer of pop culture. One of the things I realized at this rock festival that sort of kicked it all off for me was that I'd never been in a situation where everything felt simultaneously so familiar, but also so disorienting.
I want to come back to that statement that sort of kicked this off for you. Dude, they prayed like 3 times in that song. I'm having trouble formulating the question that comes out of that, because you want to say to them, why is that important?
Well, and that is exactly what I did say. And what was interesting to me was not just this one kid's answer, but what I found later talking to other people continually asking that question and questions like it was that there really isn't a single answer. There's a lot of different opinions about the proper function of pop culture within Christianity. So, for instance, this kid believed very strongly that the role of the artist in society is to transmit a message, and particularly to transmit the message of the gospel. The attitude behind that is a kind of separational one, the idea that the culture at large is inherently corrupt, and the role of Christians, the response of Christians, should be to remove themselves from it and to engage with it only to the extent that you are calling other people to come out and be separate with you. So for him, you don't just want to play music to entertain people. You want to play music to make sure that your fold stays separate and that other people can come in with you. But I met a lot of Christians who strongly disagreed with that. For instance, there are a lot of bands, Christian bands that, you know, people are familiar with, like Switchfoot or Flyleaf, that get played on mainstream radio and have some kind of crossover appeal, largely because they don't pray during their songs. And when they do sing about Jesus, they often say "you" instead of Jesus. It's the whole kind of "God is my girlfriend" song, where you don't really know what they're singing about unless you listen closely. And so the people with the separational attitude, like that kid I met, really looked down on this more integrational attitude. But those folks will say, well, our job is not to be preachers. Our job is to be entertainers. And we just want to do it in a way that's consistent with our Christian values, but not actually preaching them.
Were there places you felt particularly comfortable? There was a Christian rock festival in Illinois called the Cornerstone Festival. I think you said in the book you felt more comfortable there than you had at any other Christian event.
That's absolutely true. That was a real turning point for me.
What was different about it?
Well, I'll tell you. You know, earlier I mentioned two attitudes within Christian pop culture that I refer to as the separational and the integrational. What I realized at Cornerstone is that there's a third approach out there, which is sometimes called the transformational approach, which, unlike the other two, doesn't have a utilitarian idea about the role of art in Christian culture. So, for instance, where separational culture says, you know, we have to win people out of the mainstream, and integrational culture says we have to infiltrate into the mainstream, transformational says we have to make great art. That as Christians, if we want to honor the spirit of the Creator, we have to use our creative powers in the best and purest way possible. And this is a kind of much smaller movement within Christian culture, but I think it's a very vital and encouraging one, where you have people who aren't thinking, is this song going to win people for Jesus? They're not trying to advertise the faith. They're also not trying to cross over into the mainstream. They're trying to make great art that expresses their view of the world and what's in their hearts and in their minds. And sometimes it's overtly spiritual, the way that separational music can. You know, sometimes they do mention Jesus a lot. Other times they don't at all. They can sing about, you know, personal relationships or war or poverty. But it kind of comes from this worldview, and it's infused with this worldview that gives it a spark that's a little different from what you would hear in the non-Christian world.
Did you like the music?
Some of it is great, you know. I really was very surprised because I had only heard what most of us hear on Christian radio when you're turning the dial. The stuff that gets on Christian radio is intentionally the blandest, safest, most generic kind of music.
Of course, you could say that about most radio and most genres, couldn't you?
Absolutely. And it's for exactly the same reasons. They don't want to lose any of their audience, so they go for the lowest common denominator.
But what about the Cornerstone Festival? Were there performers you really liked there?
Yeah, I can name a whole bunch of them. There's a terrific band called Me Without You that plays very interesting and strange in the best way rock and roll. Americana band called Over the Rhine that just has beautiful melodies and harmonies. There's a band that's been playing for a long time called the 77s. And none of these names will be familiar to anyone. And they aren't, in fact, to most of the Christian culture either, because they don't get on the radio, because they are risky and they take risks. And they also challenge kind of anodyne notions of worship music. That is, their music is not just God is great, when you become a Christian, your life is perfect. Their music is about how people really live, which is messy and uncomfortable, and God doesn't always solve all the problems at the end of a 4-minute song.
Hmm. What surprised you the most as you toured these things?
Well, I had gone into this expecting to find that most Christian culture would be essentially a delivery mechanism for right-wing theology and right-wing politics. And there's certainly a lot of that. I mean, the Left Behind novels, which most people have heard of, are a good example of that.
Have you read them?
Oh, yeah. Well, I haven't read all of them. I read about as much as I could stand, and I played the video game. They're pretty terrible. I mean, they really are the kind of worst possible propaganda, terribly written, and the fact that they were so popular for so long is kind of appalling. But what surprised me was that Christian pop culture, I believe, I realized, can also be a way to counter those worst impulses within evangelicalism, in the sense that those transformational artists that I talked about, they do not like the idea of Christian culture being separate from mainstream culture. They don't want to just preach to the converted, as it were. Those bands will go out and they will tour with mainstream bands and they will play in secular clubs and they do not complain that the audiences are drinking beer, you know. And when they do that, they engage with the secular world in a very personal way. And they get to know people who are not Christians and people who are atheists or liberals or gay. And they may not, you know, change what they believe, but they do come to see that these folks are not the enemy, that they are fundamentally decent people who have something valuable to offer to society. And then they play for Christian audiences and, you know, they're rock stars. And rock stars carry a lot of weight among teenagers. And they're able to transmit these messages that they've learned back to their fans in a way that undercuts the authority of the conservative gatekeepers who would really like everybody to march in lockstep along a particular political line. So I ended up, very much to my surprise, believing that the best possible way for outsiders to engage with Christian culture is to actually really engage with it, to listen to some of this music and, you know, read some of these writers who are doing daring and provocative things. Because if we can encourage that tendency within evangelicalism, it will win people away from the more offensive and aggressive fundamentalism. And that's, I think, a much more effective approach than just attacking fundamentalists directly, which doesn't really get anyone anywhere. Not only that, I think that it benefits us because they have a message that, frankly, we need to hear. You know, it's an overtly Christian message for them. But even if you are not a Christian, to encounter a way of seeing the world that is, you know, opposed to our crass materialism and the kind of shamelessness of American culture, it can only help us, frankly.
Daniel Radosh is the author of Rapture Ready, Adventures in the Parallel Universe of Christian Pop Culture. The Joy of Sex was first published in 1972. It sold millions of copies and revolutionized how couples thought of sex and their bodies. But what do you know about Dr. Alex Comfort, the man behind the book? Probably not very much. The award-winning writer Pagan Kennedy was curious about Dr. Comfort, so she wrote an essay about him. It's the title essay in her collection The Dangerous Joy of Dr. Sex and Other True Stories. Pagan Kennedy talked to Steve Paulson about the man behind The Joy of Sex.
Alex Comfort is the kind of true character that we writers only encounter a few times in our lives, if we're lucky. You know, he started out as this sort of miserable, sad literary artist in the 1940s and 50s. He was part of a group of poets and novelists called the New Apocalyptics. And obviously he was writing very dark stuff. He got into a argument in rhyme, no less, with George Orwell about whether Britain, he was British, whether Britain should have gotten into World War II. And Alex was against this. He was a peace activist.
And he was an anarchist too, wasn't he?
He was an anarchist. And, you know, he did love, you know, the idea of blowing things up, at least. He wrote a, one of his more famous novels is called Come Out to Play, in which he imagines this drug that makes people instantly horny. And he imagines these revolutionaries who blow up Buckingham Palace and spread this drug everywhere, and then war stops because everybody's screwing everywhere.
So maybe there was a little premonition then of what his life would become. But I mean, what you're describing though is an extreme makeover. I mean, this literary man who reinvented himself to become the apostle of free love.
Yeah, and I should also say that he was, in addition to all this, a scientist. In the 1950s, he was studying snails and the mechanisms of death in fish and snails. And then what happened really was he was in a kind of conventional British marriage with one son, Nick, who I've talked to at length. And in 1960, he met up with an old friend from college, Jane Hamilton, who was a librarian at the University College of London. And they began to have a very raucous and, I would say, nerdy affair. And they had what amounted to a secret laboratory, which was her apartment, where they began these experiments. He had the Kama Sutra, and he had lots of books from all over the world about sexuality. And they began testing all these different sexual positions. I mean, they were the, and I should say Jane was a librarian, so.
and also, wasn't she a very good friend of Alex Comfort's wife?
Yes, they were all good friends, and he eventually worked out a system where he had two wives, and he would go back and forth between them in this van with a condom taped on its dashboard. And this was so out of key with the early 60s. In, I think it was 1961, Lady Chatterley's lover was slapped with an obscenity suit. You know, you couldn't get sexual manuals that were of any use. There was no, you know, it's so hard for us to imagine what that world was like when we can get information with one click. People had no way to really get any kind of information. The sexual manuals were terrible.
So here was Alex Comfort and his lover, Jane, who decided to figure it all out on their own.
Exactly. They did it, and they did it as a scientist and a librarian would, which is that they cataloged everything, organized. They created their own pamphlet, which was named, this is a very British name. It was called, at first, Doing Sex Properly. And they photographed themselves with these Polaroids. Now, keep in mind, these are intellectuals in their 40s, you know, very wonderful people, but not terribly attractive. So there's these, they produced all these sort of squishy Polaroids of various parts of themselves.
Wait, they were taking pictures while they were doing it?
Yes, they were. Because, you see, this was, they felt they were really on a mission because they really felt there was so little sexual knowledge out there. And they were going to, like two scientists, they were going to gather all the data, all the information about sexual technique and tell the world. Well, at first it started with just telling, you know, creating a little pamphlet to tell their friends. But eventually they got the idea as the late 60s came that they really were on a mission. And obviously this pamphlet would turn into The Joy of Sex. They really knew they had something here because nobody else had, quote unquote, kitchen tested all these sexual positions and, you know, knew what worked and what didn't work. And I think one thing that's not known about The Joy of Sex is it is largely from a woman's point of view. Parts of it are actually written by Jane Hamilton, who never got credit for the book. And the book was, in fact, her idea. And it's all, if you remember it, from the 70s. Everything's in alphabetical order. So anal comes before, you know, big toe, which comes before the exposition. And though I don't have any absolute proof of this, you've got to think that if there's a library, you know, she was the one who got the idea of creating an alphabetical catalog.
And then to make things sort of more amusing even, I mean, the title, The Joy of Sex, was a takeoff on The Joy of Cooking.
Exactly, which was a huge bestseller. And it was also, I think, a kind of brilliant move on their. It was not Alex's, I believe it was his publisher who came up with that title to capitalize on the popularity of the cooking book. But it was kind of brilliant move because it really said, this is a book for men and women, you know, and that couples can look at together. And it also said, this is a book that takes technique and brings it into the home. And you can be, the book is full of French, by the way, because Alex, you know, could speak French fluently. And so, and everything sounds better in French, right?
And especially the language of love, right?
Yes. And it's also the language of the 1970s, because if you'll remember, you know, everything pretended to be French back then. There was Le Bag and Le Car and Cuisinarts and French designer jeans. And so there was a sense that, you know, sex here, if you opened it up the way you might open up a cookbook to learn how to cook the way Europeans did, here you could open up this book and learn to have sex the way people in France did or India or China and become this person of the world, which was really important because in the 70s, even then, most people married pretty young and didn't have a lot of sexual experience and really wanted to, you know, broaden their horizons in a way that just wasn't available to them otherwise.
So you're really suggesting that Alex Comfort and Jane, his co-author, were seminal figures in the modern history of popular culture.
Yeah, and I think that it took me a lot of piecing together of information and just really looking at the book again to really realize just how involved Jane was. And again, she never got her due. Very few people even know her name. But she did cast a long shadow over that book. And I think the fact that it was written by a man and a woman from both points of view really changed the idea of who would be an expert about sex, you know, and who would know about sex, the idea that, you know, the woman's point of view on sex was, in fact, important and, you know, that men might listen to the women in bed with them to find out what they liked instead of sort of feeling that they had to, you know it all or just simply not listen. And Comfort was, I would say he really was quite a feminist, and it shows in the book.
Pagan Kennedy is the author of The Dangerous Joy of Dr. Sex and other true stories. She spoke with Steve Paulson. You can send us questions or comments through our website at ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. You can also find us on Facebook. You'll find a link to our Facebook group on our website. Coming up, Nathan Rabin tells us how pop culture saved his life as we conclude our Hour on the World According to Popular Culture. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Nathan Rabin is the head writer for the Onion's entertainment section, AV Club. He's also the author of The Big Rewind, a memoir brought to you by Popular Culture. In the book, Rabin chronicles the pivotal role that pop culture has played throughout his life. To the Best of Our Knowledge, producer Doug Gordon prepared this feature on Nathan Rabin and The Big Rewind.
I think I would be completely insane if it weren't for pop culture. I think I would lose my struggle with depression. It never ends, and I will always be depressive. I'll probably always be in therapy. I'll probably always be on medication. But it's something that you can fight, and I feel like pop culture has given me these tools to, if not win the war, then at least win more battles than I lose.
Nathan Rabin has had more than his share of battles during his life. As Roger Ebert says about Rabin's memoir, The Big Rewind, Nathan Rabin's life reads like a fanboy's collision with Dostoevsky. In the book, Rabin uses a specific pop culture product as a springboard to explore the different periods in his life. For example, Susanna Kazin's memoir, Girl Interrupted, is Rabin's touchstone for his own time in a mental hospital when he was 14.
I just fell deeper and deeper into like this coma of hopelessness. And there were times when I'd actually, you know, kind of fantasize about like what a mental hospital would be like. And, you know, on movies and television, there are basically two different kinds of mental hospitals, one of which is like the snake pit, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, a nightmare mental hospital where it's like the worst place in the world and nobody would ever want to be. And then the other is the sort of idyllic rural place of like relaxation and enchantment. And I'm not sure those actually exist. And one of the interesting things about Girl Interrupted is the hospital that Susanna Kazin was at was considered one of the best in the country. And it was just an incredibly empty experience for her. And it was just kind of this purgatory where you're not really growing or developing. You're just kind of like frozen in time and you're just kind of existing. So I was very, very, very unhappy. And I would fantasize about my fantasy mental hospital, which has to be pretty screwed up for that to like be occupying your 14-year-old thoughts. When I wasn't thinking about girls, I was thinking about my movies. I was thinking about my fantasy mental hospital.
Medication time. Medication time.
I remember being led to my room, and there was a boy from Peoria who was my roommate. And again, a very sweet kid, very good-natured. He really did not belong in a mental hospital. Like, he was just kind of going through stupid teenage stuff. That's what a lot of the people there were. And I remember saying to him, like, man, they put me here because they think I want to kill myself. And I didn't before, but now I really do. So he kind of politely excused himself and told the person on staff that I had just threatened to commit suicide. So I was ordered to take my mattress into the hallway and was told that I was on suicide watch for the night. And it's ironic, although I say in the book that I'm sort of a collector of bitter ironies. Some people collect stamps, some people collect baseball cards, I collect bitter ironies. So I was lying there like sobbing to myself, and the woman on staff was just kind of glaring at me and saying, you know, crying won't get you anywhere. And then a little later, I remember her telling one of the other people, like, I just don't understand why anybody thinks The Simpsons is funny. I mean, what's so funny about a father strangling his son every week? Like, what's amusing about child abuse? And I just, again, thought it was just so deeply, deeply, like, bitterly ironic that here she was expressing no empathy or compassion whatsoever for this, you know, 14-year-old boy sobbing his lungs out 5 feet away from her and here expressing all this empathy for an imaginary cartoon boy. And it's ironic, too, that I ended up interviewing Matt Groening about 15 years later. I think actually isn't ironic. I'm abusing the word ironic in Alanis Morissette-like fashion. Ray Ayane on my wedding day, yes, and a black fly in my Chardonnay. And yeah, so I thought, you know, when I interviewed Matt Groening 15 years later, of kind of mentioning to him, like, hey, how much kind of The Simpsons meant to me at that moment and how if the mental hospital hated The Simpsons, then that gave me one more reason to love them.
Here's Rabin reading an excerpt from The Big Rewind.
At Arkham Asylum, I had a chance to finally escape the prison of self, to satiate my curiosity about the world by engaging with the suffering souls around me. But I was too paralyzed with rage to connect with my fellow patients. When you're depressed, it's like there's an invisible wall separating you from the rest of the world. You long to make meaningful connections, yet there's an impenetrable barrier between you and the rest of humanity that makes that impossible. That's why there is something safe and comforting about the passivity of moviegoing. Movies and television give and give and give without asking anything in return. There was no danger that at the end of Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Pee-wee would step down from the screen, empathetically place a hand on my shoulder, and earnestly inquire, "Why do you have so much anger towards your father, Nathan? He's trying his best. He really is." Movies afforded the rewards of human interaction with none of the terrifying hazards of actual human contact. Looking back, I wish I'd made more of an effort to connect with my fellow patients to try and understand the poignant cutter girls with telltale purple scars on their wrists and the testosterone-poisoned roughneck boys. I was deaf to the poetry of their sad lives. I suffered from a fatal lack of curiosity about anything that wasn't on a big or little screen. I never bought into the idea of Arkham Asylum was anything but a cynical money-making enterprise, but as the weeks dragged on interminably, my will to fight was replaced by a pragmatic desire to get out by any means necessary. I grew obsessed with the prospect that I'd spend Christmas and New Year's under the hospital's fluorescent lights. At night, sometimes, I'd hear the muffled screams of the patients who lived on the floor above us, no-hopers who'd be leaving the hospital only in a body bag. Every anguished howl was a blood-curdling warning from the ghosts of Christmas future. I finally accepted what is perhaps the quintessential compromise of adulthood, the need to sacrifice your will and desires in order to get what you want. Came to understand the practical necessity of what Ilya Kazan calls the Anatolian smile, the pragmatic grin that masks underlying bitterness and resentment. I realized that all I had to do to get out was say the words everyone wanted to hear, that I was sorry for all the hurt I'd caused my father, which was true, that I realized how out of control I'd been, but vowed to be much better in the future.
Rabin's pop culture touchstone for the chapter A Woefully Premature Happy Ending is the 2002 film 8 Mile, starring rapper Eminem.
8 Mile is really fascinating in that it is an incredibly restrained movie. And in a lot of ways, it's very, very dark and very challenging. And so much of hip-hop is about sort of bluster and bravado and, you know, being the world's most powerful, virile man. So it was very kind of brave and noble of Eminem to depict himself in 8 Mile as somebody who is terrified of the world, of somebody who is so anxious that he throws up before he has a battle, of somebody who hates himself so much that he just can't express himself at all. And he's so deeply ashamed of everything about him and his life, you know, his mother being crazy and kind of out of control, about his girlfriend being kind of promiscuous and not very faithful to him. And what happens over the course of the movie is he finally realizes, like, all these things that I hate about myself are things that I can use. And instead of running away from it, instead of being ashamed, I can make fun of it, and I can be self-deprecating, and I can own these things, and I can have power over them instead of letting them have power over me. And I felt like that's kind of what happened with me, where growing up, I was so filled with self-hatred, and I thought of people, you know, I spent time in a mental hospital, that I grew up in a group home, that I lived with a foster family, and they rejected me, that I never knew my mother, that my dad, who I love deeply, is sick and, you know, hasn't been able to hold a job for 15 years. And I got to a certain point where I'm like, you know what? Like, I don't need to be ashamed of those things. Like, I've gotten through that. Like, it's made me a stronger person, and it's made me the man that I am today. And also popular culture, I think. I remember growing up, in my book, I say that growing up, television was so much more than just a way to spend 12 to 16 hours out of every day. But my dad would see me watching television and be like, oh, he has curing brain cancer there, huh, son? And little did they know that actually watching television and immersing myself in pop culture would actually be the thing that would get me out of where I was, that it would be kind of my ticket to this world that I desperately wanted to live in. Yo. His palms are sweaty, knees weak, arms are heavy. There's vomit on his sweater already. Mom's spaghetti, he's nervous, but on the surface he looks calm and ready to drop bombs. But he keeps on forgetting what he wrote down. The whole crowd goes so loud, he opens his mouth, but the words won't come out. He's choking how? Everybody's choking now. The clock's run out, time's up, over.
Rabin was a regular on the short-lived American Movie Classics cable TV show Movie Club with John Ridley. It was there that Rabin made a professional enemy who unleashed his inner Frank Grimes. Who is Frank Grimes? He's a character in Homer's Enemy, one of the darkest episodes ever of The Simpsons. Frank Grimes, or Grimey, as he does not like to be called, is the man who had to struggle for everything he got. When Grimey meets Homer Simpson, he can't believe how easy everything is for Homer.
God, I've had to work hard every day of my life, and what do I have to show for it? This briefcase and this haircut. And what do you have to show for your lifetime of sloth and ignorance?
What?
Everything! A dream house, 2 cars, a beautiful wife, a son who owns a factory, fancy clothes, and lobsters for dinner! And do you deserve any of it? No!
What are you saying?
I'm saying you're what's wrong with America, Simpson. You coast through life, you do as little as possible, and you leech off decent, hard-working people, like me. If you lived in any other country in the world, you'd have starved to death long ago.
He's got you there, Dad.
So within the context of Movie Club, there was a woman named Zoriana Kitt, who was an entertainment reporter for, I guess, KTLA. And yeah, it kind of seemed to me like she lived a pretty charmed life. And again, I feel bad saying that, you know, because I don't know people's entire stories, and it's possible that she really suffered, that she went through a lot of difficult things. And I kind of allude to that, but maybe I don't allude to it enough. And that kind of within this context, I very much felt like Frank Grimes, where I just had to suffer and suffer and suffer for everything that ever happened to me. If you watch Iron Man, that's Zoriana Kitt playing Zoriana Kitt. Where, yeah, she just kind of seemed to stumble into all the success. And again, it's very possible that she works really, really hard, but, you know, that's not the way that I saw it. And that I, on the other hand, had to work really, really hard. to get to where I am. And kind of pays off in that I auditioned to be a guest critic on Ebert and Roper. And this is something I wanted really, really badly. I mean, Ebert was one of my heroes growing up. Gene Siskel, there were all these parallels between our lives. And, you know, I got the call and, like, you know, I felt like I'd played some A-ball. And then the Yankees were calling me up for the World Series. I'm like, I can do this, coach. I can do this. So what I learned is that Disney was horrified by my, like, bizarre, erratic hand gestures and mannered, creepy way of talking. So I didn't get the gig. And, like, the sixth episode, I came into Keith's office, and he said, hey, do you know who the next guest critic on Ebert and Roper is going to be? And I said, it's Oriana Kidd, isn't it? And he's like, yeah. So, and then at the end of my book, I was tempted to just write, I am Frank Grimes. That's actually what I said to myself. Like, I was pounding my head against the desk immediately after learning that Oriana was going to be doing Ebert and Roper. But what I was able to see with a little hindsight was that I was incredibly lucky as well. And I have this amazing life and, you know, I've got great friends, a job I love. I'm putting out this book. People are really responding well to it. So I wrote, in the grand scheme of things, I'm 60% Frank Grimes, 30% Homer Simpson lucky bastard, and 10% moderately likable gay everyman, which is what the focus group for Movie Club said of me.
Rabin comes across as an outsider throughout most of the Big Rewind. Does he still feel like an outsider now that he's a member of the Onion's AV Club?
I think that's one of the things that we at The Onion had in common, that we were all outsiders and we were all a bunch of people with a lot of rage and a lot of disgruntlement and, you know, all this frustration. And that I found a community of outsiders in The Onion and in the AV Club. I mean, I think it's very telling that we kind of named ourselves after sort of the geekiest, you know, outcasty segment of any high school. And I feel like I've played a big role in kind of determining the tone and the nature of the AV Club. So it's like I kind of built my own playhouse where, yeah, readers and commenters and pop culture enthusiasts can frolic and do so. So I think I've found a home there. And I think that makes me feel a little less like an outsider. But I feel like we've also kind of retained an outsider sensibility and that we sort of see the world of pop culture not as like these, you know, schmoozing like insiders, like we got the inside scoop, you know, but as, again, these kind of Midwestern, wry, you know, skeptical, a little bit cynical, a whole lot idealistic, I guess, evangelists for kind of the art that we love.
Nathan Rabin is the author of The Big Rewind, a memoir brought to you by Popular Culture. He spoke with, to the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1018B, The World According to Pop Culture. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.